Well, good morning. It's a Thursday, and that means time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom. Thank you so much for joining us via the radio waves, the telephone line, the email machine, the Twitter device, the many, many ways we have to communicate nowadays, electronically and otherwise, and you are always welcome to be part of the conversation, no matter how you choose to communicate. If it's by phone, it's 850-414-1234. I think there are one or two folks within the coverage area that still have the old-fashioned landline telephone, and if it is long distance twixt you and us, we got you covered there. 800-926-8809 is that number. Email perspectives at WFSU.org or send us a tweet at WFSU Perspective. Coming up on Labor Day, and that's not only the end of the summertime season and kind of the beginning of fall and what all it brings, but it's also the traditional time for a very special event here in the Tallahassee area. That is the Bluebird Run. You can also walk for Brookie B. We're going to be talking about that in the context of suicide and suicide prevention on our program today. And we'll go around the table and meet the folks that are going to be chatting with us along that line. Say hi first to Steve Litherland, certified recovery peer specialist with the Appalachie Center, serving Jefferson, Madison, and Taylor counties. Also a peer connection facilitator for NAMI Tallahassee in Leon County, and the director of training and education for the Florida Peer Support Association. Also serves on the board for the Big Bend Mental Health Coalition, which was putting together that awesome initiative of getting mental health more accessible into our schools and a whole bunch of other stuff. A very busy guy, and also has a daughter who's running for a Tallahassee City Commission. So, Steve, you're a busy man, aren't you?
Yeah, it's kind of stressing me out. You listen to all that stuff. It made me sound important, though, and I'm not. I'm just a regular guy, but thrilled to be here and talking about mental health and suicide prevention and awareness, and something, a cause certainly that I'm passionate about, and really glad to be here with a distinguished panel of guests you have today. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and awesome you could join us for that, Steve. We welcome back to these microphones Mary Bowers, former NAMI Tallahassee Board President, whose oldest daughter, Brooke, lived with mental illness for years before dying by suicide in 2012. Dedicated to educating our community about mental illness and suicide by volunteering for the Bluebird Run and Walk for Brookie B, and the LOSS, which is an acronym for Local Outreach to Suicide Survivors Team Initiative. Mary, it is good to see you, and you're looking great.
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Okay. Can't wait to talk about the walk, run, and all that other stuff. And it's such a pleasure that Nancy invited you to be part of the panel here. Nancy Farrell, of course, with NAMI Tallahassee. And we meet up for the first time with McKenna Woods, who is a PhD candidate with FSU's College of Social Work, research pertaining to suicide by veterans, suicide intervention, prevention methods, and risk factors related to suicide in children, adolescents, young adults, and veterans. McKenna, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
All right. And we hope at some point here to be joined by Catherine Eicher, who's the lead suicide prevention coordinator for the North Florida South Georgia Department of Veterans Affairs. And if we can hook up with her, it'll be on the telephone line. So Taylor's working conscientiously on that one right now. Mary, if we could start off with you, though, just your story here with Brookie B, and you have told it multiple times, and for that we are certainly grateful. But we know we got a couple new listeners here that have not heard that tale. And although very, very tragic, it also is something from which you have derived an awful lot of hope and community involvement. So tell us about Brooke.
Oh, okay, great. Well, we started the Bluebird Run for Brookie B back in 2015 when NAMI Tallahassee approached Bill and I and asked us if we would like to help them raise money, you know, and maybe have a 5K. Bill is a runner, so he was the perfect guy for the job. So we did. We said, yeah, we'll do this. So we jumped in with both feet. And we call it the Bluebird Run for Brookie B because our house is adjacent to the J.R. Alfred Greenway, 900 acres out there that Brooke and I used to, we had our little path that we would walk together. And, of course, Bill runs out there all the time. And there are a number of bluebird houses stationed along the different courses. So that's why we came up with Bluebird Run for Brookie B. It's just kind of sweet. Plus that bluebird, you know, supposed to be the bluebird of happiness or whatever. So that very first year, it really took off. We were totally surprised at the number of people who came. The support was just overwhelming. It was tough for us that first year. You know, because it's supposed to be a happy thing, but sometimes, you know, it can trigger memories of when she died back in 2012. And you miss her, you know, you really do. But then over the years, we've been getting stronger, and we've been building the Bluebird Run up to the point now where we've got over 500 people who come. So it's a lots of fun, and I can talk more about that. I could talk about that forever, really. It's a fun, very, very special event.
Well, we will talk more about it for sure, Mary. But McKenna, what I wanted to talk with you a little bit about your research here, mm-hmm. particularly as it pertains to like target populations, veterans, young people, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And what is the research telling us about suicide and the incidence of that in these populations? Going up, going down, steady, what?
Well, as of recently, the suicide rate has actually increased by 28% since 1999 across all age groups. So it's been steadily increasing. That's what the research has been saying.
Beyond the numbers, what's the motivator, if you will, or the factors that are playing into this increase?
Well, it depends on what population you're talking about. If we're talking about veterans, it can be anything from, you know, combat exposure and seeing things that desensitize you to the fear of death and to pain associated with death and, you know, that state of hypervigilance that doesn't get turned off once you come back into civilian life. Or if we're talking about adolescents, it can be anything from bullying in school to, you know, not feeling supported or, you know, feeling ostracized from your peers. It just depends on the population.
A kind of angst gone crazy. That seems to be at least a perception on the part of a lot of grown-ups that, oh, it's just teen drama and it got out of control.
I think part of the narrative that we're trying to change in terms of, you know, educating the population is that it's not angst. It's mental illness that just goes untreated, really, you know, and with parents who think that they're just going through a phase as opposed to believing that, you know, there actually is depression, there actually is suicide ideation. They actually do need to be speaking to professionals and be getting treatment for things.
Yeah, and Steve Letherland, you were saying about out in the lobby, it is something that can impact everyone. You went through this, for crying out loud.
I did. I struggled with mental illness, of course, most of my life. And I started having suicidal ideations when I was about 15 years old. And it was really, really difficult, something I had struggled with. I had reached out, I remember, to a school teacher. And I was, unfortunately, at the time, shunned and shamed and told to never speak of it again. And then later, a few years later, I reached out to a clergyman of the church. And from a religious perspective, heard an objection to having those type of thoughts as being the ultimate sin and something to never speak of. And my experience was negative, to not reach out, to not ask for help. And I remember listening to a radio show, a national sports radio show, because I was a jock and loved that kind of stuff. And I heard the former quarterback for the Detroit Lions, his name's Eric Hippel, first speaking about suicidal ideations. And I pulled the car over and stopped and turned the radio up. It just struck me that this athlete that I had admired really had the courage to speak out about it. And the message was amazing. But my takeaway was that there is help. There is treatment. You're not alone. It's nothing to be ashamed of. And you can get help and live a better life. And really, it was the first time I'd ever heard that. And it just really had an impact on me then. Unfortunately, I didn't get treatment right away, but it's certainly something I had thought about and considered. And then later, ultimately, I ended up making an attempt Fortunately, I survived, and I'm just glad to be here today. I try to help people as a peer specialist through my own lived experiences and let them know that I'm here to help too.
And Mary Bowers, this reminds me of sort of the Voldemort of mental health, in that we don't mention its name, or we try not to. As both Steve and McKenna said, these are things that you can be branded. The stigma is still incredible on this. If you think about it, then that's it.
Yeah, true enough. But that's not, people need to remember that it's okay to think about it. Most people do think about it once in a while. I mean, I don't know if it's most, but a lot of people think about it.
Boy, ask McKenna. I bet she has research.
But, you know, the important thing is that if you are thinking about it, that you talk to somebody and reach out for that help, because it can be prevented, but you need to understand what the illness is about, you know, and know that there is hope, like Steve said. I think that there are, you know, in Brooke's case, when her boyfriend died, when they were 16, in high school, it was during the spring of their junior year. So she died January 13th, and he died January 16th, but 15 years apart. So she suffered, you know, she had a tough time after he died. But when we had to raise the conversation about, and again, it's a health system sometimes, and that's why we really need to be careful. Things are so much better now than they were back then, so that's a good thing. But, you know, sometimes a psychiatrist, for her, when she was suicidal, they were saying, oh, it's just grief. You just, you know, give it 6 months and, you know, you're going to be okay. But that's, you know, it doesn't always just go away. And getting her started on medication, she's like, don't tell anybody I'm on medication. They're going to think I'm, you know, a crazy woman or something. So after a while, though, with her dealing with these mental health issues for so long, you know, she really became a NAMI advocate. She and I got trained as in a program called Provider Education. So, you know, she was involved in NAMI. Unfortunately, there for a while then, her eating disorder kind of took over things, and she couldn't do as much as she wanted to, but...
We'll tell the rest of the story on the other side of this break, coming up here on Perspectives. And you can join the conversation, too, 850-414-1234. A helpful, friendly reminder, you can always find Perspectives online at WFSU.org. Just go to that aforementioned URL, click on Radio, pull down the Programs menu, and then punch up Perspectives. We archive past shows, try to have the latest program up within, well, 24 hours of when it actually airs. And a reminder, too, along a programming line, that we are going to be doing more political perspectives in the run-up to the general election. That's going to take place tentatively. We got that set for the week of the 8th and the 15th of October. Coming to you from these studios, we'll see how many candidate races get out of the primary mix next Tuesday, and then we'll go on from there. But right now we're talking about the upcoming Bluebird Run Walk for Brookie B, and the whole idea of, on one hand, when it comes to suicidal ideation or thoughts, yes, we need to be more forthcoming and to share that. And this thought is not leaving my head, and I need to get in touch with someone who can help me to deal with this. But the moment I tell someone, again, the brand will go on, and whether it's my employer, whether it's my family members, bad things are going to happen. McKenna Woods, why is that still the way?
I don't know if I can give you a clear answer to that. I think that it's hard for people to talk about things. And I think that people are worried about being given a label and being considered either just mentally ill or, you know, just a certain way, as opposed to being somebody who lives with this mental illness. And so instead of bringing it up and talking about it, they don't. Or they are afraid that if they do disclose something to somebody that they love, that, you know, that person will not believe that what they're experiencing is real. And so, you know, there's not much of a clear indication as to why. It's just the stigma associated with mental illness in general, and especially that of the taboo of suicide. And just that's just the narrative that is just perpetuated.
Yeah, is the ideation perhaps, again, so widespread because it seems that even people without a chronic mental illness at least have those passing thoughts, whether it's tied to a specific event, the death of a loved one, a reversal at work. You just get down for whatever reason, think, oh, if I did this, maybe it would all be better. Oh, and then it's gone. It passes. Rather than coming back and back. Maybe, mm-hmm. Steve, can you give us any insight on that?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's absolutely true, that some people may have a fleeting thought here and there. With me, it was a little bit more serious in that I have a diagnosis. I'm bipolar 1. And I say it intentionally that way in layman's terms because I'm going to reject the stigma. I'm not ashamed of it. But I certainly deal with it all the time. I was corrected the other day, and I got a chuckle out of it. And I said, no, you're actually someone that lives with a mental illness or someone that lives with bipolar disorder. And I said, no, I'm actually bipolar 1. And that's how I choose to identify intentionally because I want to be crystal clear what I'm trying to say. I'm going to own it and not be ashamed of it. It's okay to talk about it. But relative to that, when I was in that state, from my personal experience, it wasn't rational at all. They weren't rational thoughts, and I wasn't in control. That was my mental illness taking hold of me. And now I've learned to control it instead of the opposite of that. So it doesn't make sense. There's nothing rational about it in that state. And particularly for me, I was a businessman, successful, educated. Things were going great. Great family. Why on earth would I have come to that conclusion? But I did. And it's something I never thought I would consider until I did, or attempt until I did. Just really hard. You know, someone with my diagnosis specifically, 25% of the people with bipolar disorder take their own lives. It's a staggering number. There is help. It is treatable. And certainly something that I have to, well, I have the privilege of helping people with just about every week. I mean, it's pretty amazing what's going on in our area here specifically.
A psychologist of my acquaintance mentioned something that stuck with me several years ago, and that is that mental illness has its own rules of the road as far as logic and reasonable thought processes are concerned, that to the person who is suffering with that, everything makes perfect sense.
Right.
And now to the outside world, you think, this is not rational. It is not logical. But to the person who's inside that bubble, it is. This is normal, normative behavior.
Absolutely. And I certainly would agree with the expert, and I'm not that. I'm an expert in me, and I guess that's really what's the difference from a peer specialist. I don't ever claim to be that important. My role is to just say, hey, you know what? I've been there. Kind of like Eric Hipple did on the radio that day for me, you know, touched me and say, there's some help, and here's what I did that worked. And when we do see the red flag shoot up, to know enough as a trained peer specialist to say, let's go get a professional, let's go get a licensed clinician involved, let's get a psychiatrist involved and get you the help that you need.
Mary Bowers, when Brookie died by suicide in 2012 and since then, how many lives and families do you think that your experience, her experience, has touched?
Oh, geez, hundreds, I would say, because every year, I mean, we get, I suppose, 500 people to our event, but a lot of people, it's amazing how many people say to me, oh, yeah, I knew Brooke, and I'm like, how did you know her? Whatever, and then they'll give me a story, or This one woman in particular at Brooks, either the wake, it must have been the wake, came up to me and said, "Hey, you know, I knew Brooke. I was a patient in the hospital when Brooke was there, and I now work at that hospital. And it was because of Brooke that I went into the field of social work." And she basically saved my life because they had a little mini support group of their own, the inpatient, on the inpatient unit. So they just would get together and kind of talk. And she said Brooke was just an inspiration to me, even though she was so, you know, ill. But I've got her to thank for where I'm at now. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's got to make you feel that.
Yeah.
You know, oh, and you know, that little pebble in the pond, where are those little waves going to go?
Yeah.
That is sweet. Joining our conversation here on Perspectives, the lead suicide prevention coordinator for the North Florida, South Georgia Department of Veterans Affairs is Catherine Eicher. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for calling in. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me.
Hey, we were bringing you up to speed on the conversation thus far, going over some of the research that is out there. McKenna was telling us about some of the veterans stats that she's been looking at in her research, and Mary Bowers talking about her daughter, Brooke, and the upcoming event that is a commemorative and also an awareness builder. And Steve Letherland here, of course, is with us as well. But specific to veterans in this neck of the woods, since we are a pretty intensive area when it comes to veterans, I think we have, 18,000 just in Leon County alone, somewhere around there. What's the situation with suicide and veterans in our region, Catherine?
Well, specifically, throughout the United States, there are 20 veterans that die by suicide every day in the United States. So specifically to our area here in North Florida, South Georgia, unfortunately, we are part of some of those statistics. However, we have had a lower rate of suicide as opposed to the national average for the last several years.
Certainly good news there, but for those veterans in our area, what kind of resources are available if they're having suicidal ideation?
Sure.
Need to talk to someone? What you got?
So specifically, what the VA has done is we have provided same-day access to care at every single one of our clinics throughout the United States, including those in Leon County. We have also expanded our use of predictive modeling, which uses a statistical approach to identify veterans who may be at risk for the potential for adverse events, including suicide. So that's something new that we have incorporated into our work with our veterans. We have expanded our telehealth services as well as our women's services, and we're constantly improving our programs, such as our homeless program and our mental health intensive case management program, to help reduce risk of suicide. So it's a constant process that we're looking at every day throughout the VA, as well as specifically here in North Florida, South Georgia, to help reduce the risk of suicide with our veteran population.
One of the things I visited not too long ago, we're going to be doing an expanded news story on it before too terribly long, is that every Thursday at the Lake Ella American Legion, there is a group of volunteer counselors, lawyers, employment specialists, all that, who get together to try to help veterans who are experiencing some real reversals in life. And that can even include things like outstanding warrants and misdemeanor charges, and they can't get their license, and they can't find a place to live, and all that sort of thing. Are you folks also interconnected with that resource so that any veterans who come into that group would get the proper referrals if they're thinking of suicide?
Yes, we have veteran justice outreach specialists that work with our veteran population, and they can always refer to the suicide prevention team as well. And also, I want to note that we have our Veterans Crisis Line that is an invaluable resource as well. So for veterans who or individuals working with veterans who may not have somebody from the VA right there to refer them to, they can always use that Veterans Crisis Line to make a referral on behalf of that veteran if they're concerned about them, or give that information to the veteran or their family member.
Okay, do you happen to have that line handy? Because if some folks may be listening right now, Catherine, they go, oh my gosh, I need that number.
Sure, sure. It's 1-800-887, I'm sorry, excuse me. That number is 1-800-273-8255, and press 1 for the Veterans Crisis Line.
Okay, just wanted to get that out there in case anyone was listening and thought, that sounds like a number I should be giving a ring to. McKenna Woods, sure. If I could ask you the, all these personal situations here. A young man of my acquaintance said, you know, I don't know what it is with these veterans nowadays. They have all these problems. You have this suicide incidents. Our dads and our granddads went through wars. They never did stuff like this. And he became really upset about this. What does your research show? Is this just this particular group of veterans since we got involved in Iraq and Afghanistan and places? Or is this kind of par for the course?
It's par for the course. I think that we just talk about it more and we have more access to the information than we did before. But also, you know, the Middle East conflict has seen a lot more deployments, longer durations at being deployed, and then less time when you're back home between deployments. And so there's more exposure as that than there was before. Sorry, and it's just, you know, the Middle East conflict has been the longest standing war. It surpassed Vietnam. Since, what was it, 2001? And so, you know, there's just a lot more soldiers themselves who are exposed to this crazy amount of violence.
Yeah, and also the fact, as you said, the multiple deployments. Mm-hmm. Each time you go with the stop-loss program and all of that, the mm-hmm. incidence increases, I think, not arithmetically, it could be geometrically.
Exponentially.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I think part of it, too, is that, you know, military culture itself, it's kind of you don't talk about it. You don't talk about the things that are going on in your head. You don't talk about the treatment that you might need. You don't talk about the mental illnesses you might be experiencing, because you don't want to be considered weak by your peers. You don't want your band of brothers, as it were, to think that you're weak in any way. And that is, you know, kind of indoctrinated into you in this military culture. And then when you're transitioning back into civilian life, that switch doesn't flip. And it's still something that's kind of held within them in terms of not going to seek treatment and not talking about it.
Well, Steve Litherland, we see that we are guys. We are big, strong, manly men. We don't talk about this stuff.
That's right. That was what I was certainly taught to believe when I was growing up. You couldn't even have tears, for that matter. You know, I was really intrigued a second ago in the conversation about the veterans. You know, my grandfather fought in World War II. My father's a Vietnam vet. It was happening then. Mm-hmm. We're just talking about it now, and that's the difference. And it's really a credit to the great work that Catherine and folks like her are doing with our veterans to help bring that number down. You know, the new report here this year, 20 veterans every day in our country take their own lives. That's actually dropped from previous year. Was 22, I believe. And that's a report from the Department of Veterans Affairs. And it's a credit to the great work that they're doing. People are talking about it now. It's making a difference. We're raising the bar in terms of awareness.
While we think of guys, and I think statistically this is true, that men tend to die by suicide more often than do women, in the case of Brooke, Mary, mm-hmm. you know, this impacts everyone.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of her friends. So after she died, that was one of my biggest concerns, because we know that survivors who are left behind are also at risk for killing themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's why we've been working hard in NAMI Tallahassee and with our loss team to try to reach out to more and more survivors of suicide loss to get them help too.
Yeah, because suicide is a contagious disease.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how does the research show that too, McKenna?
If I can just, in terms of actual deaths by suicide, in America alone, it's the 10th leading cause of death. And just for, you know, kind of perspective, homicide is 16th. And in terms of non-fatal outcomes, for every one attempt, or for every one death, there's about 25 to 30 attempts for suicide. And for every one death, there's upwards of 150 people who are affected by that death. And so, you know, that's what the research is talking about. And then based on over 8 million since 1992 people who have died by suicide, there's at least or greater than 5 million people who are affected by those deaths. So it's a huge crisis that we're looking at.
We're talking about a situation that dare not speak its name, at least for many of us, we dare not speak the name, which is suicide. And that is our topic here on Perspectives with Steve Litherland, Mary Bowers, McKenna Woods, and now joined by Catherine Eicher with the Department of Veterans Affairs with us via telephone. We'd love to hear from you, too. 850-414-1234 is our number, or you can drop us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org. We'll be right back. We are back on Perspectives, and before we go any further, Mary Bowers, please give us all the lowdown here on the upcoming Bluebird Run Walk for Brookie Bee that's coming up September 3rd, Labor Day.
Great. Sure. So you can go online and register. That would be awesome at www.bluebirdrun.com. So we've got some awesome shirts that will be available. You can also volunteer. I think we have right now around 120 people signed up and about 70 volunteers, so that's good. The new thing that we started last year, and are going to continue this year that's just really been cool is that we have this section of the Greenway that we call Memory Lane. So survivors of suicide loss can bring in pictures of their loved ones, or they can write little messages like, there is hope, or whatever, or bring pictures of their family, or their favorite pet, or whatever. And we will have a resource table there for the survivors of suicide loss, and a little survivor ribbon that people can wear. And it's just been so awesome because people don't really think, you know, they're so lonely. There's not a lot of people that they can talk to about this subject. And they can come to our table and see a lot of us. We're there. And guess what? We're doing great. It may have been difficult at first, but it gives them hope, you know, that they can make it. The journey may be a little longer than they think, but eventually they'll get there.
Aw, thank you, Mary. Well, we've got some calls coming in. Let's start off with Marcus. You're on line two. Hey, Marcus, welcome to Perspectives. Hello, Marcus.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, go right ahead, sir.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to say hello to you because I happen to know Steve, and he is a fantastic advocate for the mentally ill
here
in the Tallahassee area.
Hey, I thought that was you, man. I said, you know, I wonder if that's my friend. He's actually a brilliant dude studying here at FSU. Very proud. Maybe he'll tell you that.
I am studying here at FSU College of Medicine to try to become a psychiatrist. But I also live with bipolar disorder myself. and I am a veteran as well. And so my primary comment is I wanted to say I've been getting care through the VA system for a number of years for mental health, and I've gotten excellent care. I've noticed deficiencies in other areas, but not in the mental health space. So I'm very appreciative of that. And then I guess the only other thing I wanted to add is, you know, the brain is an organ, just like the heart or the lungs or any other organ. And I think if you are, you know, say you don't have mental illness, but you notice someone's symptoms are present in some way that you suspect might be mentally, you know, related to their mental illness, or they may you suspect they may have a mental illness. Just if you view it as an organ and symptoms of that organ, in this case the brain, I think it really puts it into a context which is a little bit more approachable. And I don't know, I find that helpful to me as I interact with peers who are mentally ill as well as, you know, other people who don't have mental illness.
God, that's a wonderful observation, Marcus. It's just like saying, well, you know, I've got diabetes. Okay. You know, I'm dealing with it. I've sought help for it, and it's being taken care of. But I know that I've still got a ways to go. And sort of that type of reaction?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Both of my parents actually have diabetes. And I think there is a, you know, there is a very valid comparison between, you know, chronic mental illness and chronic diabetes or other physical, chronic conditions. Obviously, this one can kill you very quickly through suicide, which you're talking about, and you have to be very aware of that. And I think the walks and other awareness events are fantastic. And I think it gives a lot of empowerment to not only people who are survivors, but other people like myself. I've participated in other walks elsewhere. So, but I really appreciate everything that everyone on this call is doing.
Well, really appreciate the input from you, Marcus. Take care. And again, thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for calling, buddy. We couldn't have planned that better, man. Wow. I almost scripted that. That's cool.
Well, let's go for two because we got Jude on line three, and I think there's a connection there, too. Hey, Jude, welcome to Perspectives.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome.
Hi, Jude. I recognize that voice.
Hello, Mary.
Hey, Jude.
I wanted to call. My comment, Mary, is for you. You were talking about Brooke and the person who told you that she was such a big help to them. And I wanted to mention that also for myself. I struggle with suicidality, mental health issues for myself. And attending Brooke's funeral that day really helped me to see the impact this suicide has on others. And it helped me to not want to go that route. I feel like, as you said, it increases the risk for some people. For me, I felt like it decreased it.
That is wonderful. And Steve, if I can ask you to jump in here a sec. That getting outside of oneself, because if you are having suicidal ideation, again, from my buddy the psychologist, his whole thing is you are within a very self-contained bubble. It is hard to look outside of that to see what this impact would be on other people. But as Jude said, if you're kind of smacked upside the head with, oh my gosh, if I do this, these are some of the consequences for others, that can be a demotivator.
Sure, it can be. First, I want to touch on what Jude had said a little bit about Brooke specifically. She's still saving lives. And it's moving to me, and it chokes me up, too, just thinking about the impact that Mary and Bill have had on our community and what she's done. Her contribution is phenomenal. When someone's in that bubble, Tom, like you had mentioned, and I had spoken to before, it's just not rational. It's really hard to say you can't do this because you have family or because of these other people. I know for me, my perspective was, well, they'd all be better off were I not here. I'd actually be doing them a favor. So it's pretty hard to surround folks with guilt and have them not want to do that. Or even maybe there's a faith objection to it. It's always a serious thing when somebody's having suicidal ideations, things to look out for. Like maybe everybody'd be better off if I weren't around. expressions of hopelessness. Maybe they've had a previous attempt. Their daring or risky taking behavior, changes in personality. Sometimes depression is visible. Maybe they're giving away prized possessions or even having a lack of interest in future plans. Those are all huge warning signs and red flags that we need to jump in there and do something about it.
All right. And that's something, Catherine Eicher, if I can get you involved in this too, that band of brothers syndrome that we think of when it comes to a veterans issue, it is, having seen this myself many, many times, no one knows you better than your buds.
Correct.
And what should they be looking out for? Because they BS and talk smack and all this other kind of stuff
sure.
that they normally do. But at what point do you go, uh-oh, we need to do something here?
Right. Significant changes in behavior are always an indicator, but also subtle changes in behavior, like maybe isolation, maybe not engaging with the group as much as they had previously, maybe work tasks are not being completed in a timely manner, or they're expressing things such as interpersonal issues, such as that they miss their family, they're not sure what's going on at home, things like that. People who see are these individuals every day are the ones really on the front lines to identify just even subtle changes in behavior. And when those seem to be consistent and they're not getting better, in fact, they're getting worse.
And it can be something as easy as or as subtle as a change in reaction, things that we used to be able to talk to Ed about this kind of stuff all the time, and now he's lashing out or he's gotten sullen,
right.
Some type of change in personality.
Absolutely. Or increase in drug or alcohol use. Mm-hmm. That's also a big indicator that something's not okay.
Okay. Oh, McKenna Woods, back to you on this, because so many parts of the country, not so much Tallahassee and adjoining South Georgia yet, but the opioid situation is being perceived as a kind of, what do we call it, a slow motion, and sometimes it's a fast motion suicide for some folks, that this is another way of dying by suicide, and it seems accidental.
I would perceive some of it as being a maladaptive coping mechanism. You know, self-medication in terms of alcohol or drug use is something that a lot of people use to be able to cope with the things that they're experiencing. You know, people who don't seek mental health treatment will drink a lot or do a lot of drugs, and that turns into a whole other slew of addiction issues and things in terms of mental illness.
And at what point does that become obviously self-destructive? One overdose, two, 10?
I think it's unique to the individual, and it depends on the circumstances. And I think that as soon as you see a change in behavior for anybody, that you should definitely intervene and ask questions and be there for them.
Okay, terrific. Rick joins us here on line two. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Perspectives. Hey, Rick.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Great. Go right ahead, sir.
Okay. Following up a little bit on what Marcus was saying about the brain being an organ like any other organ, only it's kind of the last frontier as far as learning about it goes. 2 points. Number one is the spoken word is the most powerful drug available, which emphasizes the need to get people at risk of suicide to those trained to help, because the words spoken really do change the brain. And secondly, sort of unrelated, is just something someone can use, and that is to advise someone that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, to try to, you know, get their thinking turned around a little bit as a starter anyway.
I love that. What do you think, Steve?
I'm not 100% certain. Maybe in his spoken word reference, Rick, were you possibly alluding to faith in recovery? Is that what you're talking about, Rick?
Say that again?
Were you alluding to maybe faith as being a part of recovery?
No, not at all.
Okay, okay. I'm sorry. I wasn't sure.
No, just that counseling, the words spoken.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just tremendously powerful.
I absolutely agree with you, Rick. Cognitive therapy has changed my life. Coping skills that I learned really primarily from peers, too. Things just to do, simple things to help me get through the day. And, for example, we're talking specifically about suicide. Part of what I did with suicidal ideations is use a few coping skills, one being replacing a negative thought, just to think of something peaceful, something relaxing. Maybe I remove myself from the situation. If I'm in an area and that thought's coming through my mind, I'll go somewhere else. Maybe I'll find a positive distraction and start another activity, something creative. Those are just a handful of basic coping skills that really helped me defeat it. You know, I got a diagnosis, I got medication, and I wasn't fixed. I felt better, but I wasn't fixed. I was still having those thoughts, and it was a combination of cognitive therapy, to your point, Rick, and also learning some real-world coping skills. That's such a buzzword in mental health, but they really work, and there are specific ones that you can learn. And it's really helped me and changed my life, as you say, Rick, the spoken word. So thank you so much for bringing that up.
Yeah, that and getting outside and walking.
Absolutely.
In a natural setting. So thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
And thank you, Rick, and I hope you'll continue the therapy by joining the walk on Labor Day, September 3rd, the Bluebird Run and Walk for Brookie B. See if we can squeeze in David here on line 3. Hi, David. Welcome to Perspectives. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Yeah, I have a question about bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
Okay, the question is, this disorder, it affects, I mean, not just the person involved, but actually it affects the people around that person, like, you know, partners and spouse and family members and this sort of thing. And if the person who has bipolar is not cooperating, where do the family members and spouse and partner, where do they turn to get help?
Oh, great question. Okay, Mary.
Hey. So the NAMI family-to-family classes are tremendous. So what we did, what Bill and I did, we attended a 12-week class that NAMI puts on. After Brooke moved from Wisconsin and moved down to Tallahassee to be with us after she graduated from college. But we didn't know what we were going to do with her because it seems things were getting worse and worse, and we didn't understand. So a friend of mine who was involved in NAMI at the time just said, why don't you guys go take this class? And I really don't think it's too far of a reach to say it changed our perception tremendously. So we learned so much about this free 12-week class. So the biggest takeaway for me, I think, was sometimes what I have to do is take care of myself first, and I cannot control everything with my daughter. You do the best you can. For us, there's things, strategies that we came up with. I could say to Brooke, are you okay? You know, back to the conversation about talking. Are you okay? Do you need to go to the hospital? That was our code for, are you thinking of suicide? You know, so bringing up the topic does not make them think, doesn't make your loved one think about it more. It just opens that conversation. So, you know, make sure to feel like you can talk to the person, even if they're not cooperative. You can still say, you know, do you want us to call 911 for you, or you can call that number that Catherine mentioned, the 1-800-273-8255. They have counselors on staff 24/7 who can help you deal with that, because it's going to be difficult to help your loved one if you're not understanding and if you're frustrated.
Well, that's it. If you get angry, ticked off, and withdraw, that is not the right reaction.
Just keep trying, right.
Yeah. Folks, so that brings us to the end of our conversation, and we could go on for at least another couple of hours. And thank you all so much again. The Bluebird Run and Walk for Brookie B coming up September 3rd at the beautiful Alford Greenway. Mary Bauer, Steve Litherland, McKenna Woods, and Catherine Eicher, thank you so much for being on Perspectives today and sharing your insights and your wisdom today. We appreciate it so very, very much. Perspectives produced by WFSU in Tallahassee. Technical assistance from Taylor Cox and Lydell Rawls today, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Taking a few days off next week after our election night coverage, Regan McCarthy will take the point for Perspectives. We'll chat again on the September 6th show. Our guest will be the leadership team for the Leon County School District, so be ready to get your report card. That'll be coming up then. Take care.
Copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.